coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this incredible pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. This is the last of our fully pre-records. While I am on the road, I'm currently bilocating in Las Vegas, Nevada. This evening, we have an interesting show. In the second part, we will be talking about Stephen Myers. We will be talking with Stephen Myers, rather, of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation regarding construction of the pyramids, as well as the idea of false pyramid paradigms. So the ideas of things like the pyramid is a tomb, that kind of stuff. Things that seem falsified, but seem to be carried on in Egyptology. What were those things? We don't know, but we know what they aren't by classical Egyptology and what they define themselves. So we'll be getting into some of those pyramid paradoxes this evening in the second part. In our first part, good friend and guest Jason Quitt, his website is The Crystal Sun. We have had him on to talk about everything from Oralite 23 to sacred alignments to his books, Gates of the Anunnaki and more, even astral genesis. Today we will be talking about sacred geometries and sacred alignments. So welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you today?
I'm good. Always a pleasure to be back and to share with you and your audience.
Absolutely, man. I love our conversations because they always go way beyond the tagline of what the episode segment is about. And since meeting, I first met you at Stairway to the Stars, Jimmy Church's event in Vegas, actually. And since our dinner that night and going over things, just diving into your research over the last few years and seeing the new things that you have released and the regular volume at which you release data, Jason, is more than impressive. But your research into sacred geometries and how they have transitioned through time, how they have transitioned through esoteric cult after esoteric cult, using the same kind of geometry to convey the same message, is truly fascinating. And I think stands above a lot of people in this field. So thank you for all that you do regarding this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let's start at the beginning. How did you first come to studying sacred geometries and alignments, things like that? What first brought you into this field of study, Jason?
That's a really good question. I think it was back in the day when I started to go through, just trying to learn everything. There was a teacher here by the name of Robert Gilbert and Dr. Kareem. Now, we're going back like, oh my God, how long ago is this? It's got to be almost 20 years ago, if not more. And so Robert Gilbert had the Vesica Institute, I believe, and he would come up to Toronto with Dr. Kareem and talk about biogeometry, sacred geometry, things like this. And this was before Gaia, before any of these things.
Yeah.
And so I became friends. I became friends with them. I went down to the Vesica Institute in Asheville, North Carolina, spent some time there. So this is like almost like way back in the beginning. I was very curious about dowsing. Mm. You know, like I have, you know, the different pendulums.
I have that exact pendulum.
Yeah. So I
thank you, Arcturus Ra.
So I would, I was really into that kind of scene back then. Mm. And I would just get into all these really obscure books. I think, what was his name? John Mitchell. was very famous in writing sacred geometry books, a big fan of his. And that kind of opened me up to, into this kind of language of sacred geometry, frequencies, angles, and how it's almost like a language of the universe and how we could translate different physical forms as these building blocks for even esoteric teachings, symbology, things like that. So that's really where my background is in sacred geometry. So I'm very grateful to all my teachers in the past that kind of led me down this road. So now I'm kind of like fluent a little in, you know, seeing these and then understanding what's behind certain artworks. And this is why I love like Leonardo da Vinci and a lot of these painters who use sacred geometry to literally build their art. And we don't see how they use it, but if you have the right eye, you understand their proportions and where they place things, and you go, okay, they're using this type of knowledge in the paintings.
Yeah, and it goes beyond, and you know, for anybody that studied generalized art history, things like that, or even fine art in college, you definitely learn some of these principles. You learn some things like Fibonacci sequence and how that relates to the ratios of, you know, the diagram of man, things like that. However, and even the ratios in which, like, even as a videographer and photographer, the rule of thirds is a prime example where you position the object to be focused at in thirds of the screen. You know, that's why whenever you look at people in interviews, stuff like that, whether slightly offset, it forces your eye to look at them, to look at that. Now, when you marry these perspectives that are used in art with the sacred geometry, that's when you really start getting a message. That's when you move beyond the mundane of, hey, you, look at this seashell and what the meaning of that seashell is.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing about art and these initiations into this knowledge is that you can tell a story to two different audiences. So, yeah. You know, you could present an image that is very straightforward and it tells a story to, let's say, the general public. But then you show that image to someone who has been initiated into seeing the structure of the painting. And suddenly there's a whole other story embedded in that picture that only those that can see it can see it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've just popped up on screen for listeners out there, the what's called the pentagram of Venus, that if you look at this, this is the way that Venus actually rotates in the cosmos, in our solar system, around the sun, things like that. When you see this in front of you from an omniscient view, like this is sacred geometry. And when you see these rosette patterns, things like that expressed, like, yeah, that's frequently what they were doing, was showing you that this pattern exists in the cosmos.
Yes. And, you know, the number 21.6 degrees actually helps create that. So it's like you have to know these sacred numbers and how they relate to, let's say, Venus to get the pentagram.
Yeah.
So you have this kind of sacred geometry language, and the whole thing with sacred geometry, why they call it sacred to begin with, is because it's like you're trying to learn the fingerprint of creation. And by knowing the fingerprint of creation, you now know the hand of the artist. So it's like that is the creator, because it follows a very specific law of geometry. And when you go into alignment with that, then you're speaking the language of creation itself. And this is why, you know, artwork or buildings or architecture that is set up with these yeah. sacred numbers has a very dramatic impact on you and your subconscious and your energy, because it's set up with the ratios and the angles and geometry of creation itself, like the Fibonacci sequence. Yeah.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. I'm gonna reference a conversation with my friend Anseline. Hey, Anseline. We were literally talking about sacred spaces not too long ago. She'd stepped into a Catholic church and is not a Catholic, not a churchgoer or anything like that, Jason. But she messaged me and she was like, I don't know why it is, but whenever I step in to a Catholic church, I am always so deeply spiritually moved. And I was like, because the construction is literally based on sacred geometry. Like if you go into a cathedral, it is based on the geometry of the Temple of Solomon. Like it is based to geometrically connect you with the divine to put you in that space and vibration. Like it's made to do so.
Yeah. And then when you have the prayers and the songs and the mantras and the music, it's oscillating the air and bouncing it, reverberating it off the sacred geometry.
Yep.
You know, you're putting yourself into a very sacred space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the point that because of the distances and cubic resonance of the room, the rooms resonate at a certain frequency. They reverb at a certain frequency that helps only support this and move it into the auditory as well as the visual and the vibrational. So it's fascinating when you start getting into how long this kind of technology has been used. One of the main examples that I give regularly is the giant stuff in Corsica, where it's the huge cave that has been built that specifically resonates at 19 hertz. You know, Malta, rather, in Malta. And the idea that these things bring on states. They transport you. You can call them a stargate if you want. You can whatever terminology you like. But the resonance of the space itself can do that for you.
I mean, there's patents out right now that anybody could look up, even from DARPA and different places, where they know that certain oscillations from delta, so like very low frequencies, to like you were saying about 20 hertz, those definitely have effects on our subconscious and conscious minds. They could put us to sleep. They could do hypnotic suggestions. They could do altered states just by being in those low frequency oscillations.
Yeah, precisely. And the idea that, once again, these geometries are key. Understanding because it's not like it's being done like in a modern, because even in a modern day space, even in a modern studio, we have amazing computer programs where you can drop in the dimensions of your space and the speakers that you want to use, and it will give you the prime placement so that you don't have reflection off the back wall and things like that. We have all kinds of audio treatments and, you know, huge foam cubes you can put in the corner to stop bass frequencies and all kinds of, in my window right now, I've got a baffle to keep part of the neighbor's noise out, you know, but they didn't necessarily use things in that kind of way at that point. They used the actual raw resonance of a room.
Yes. And then again, it's like, what knowledge did they have to understand this concept? It's, you know, these are not random things that, you know, they're just placing it and then like trial of error. They're just putting it together and saying, oh, this works or this doesn't work. It's like they had to go in with a plan and say, if we build it to these ratios, or if we hollow out this cave to take out this amount of volume and space, we're going to get this effect. So how do they know this information? You know, this is stuff that's, you know, we would figure out with computers right now to try to figure out how this would work and how this would reverberate.
Yeah. And I mean, even binaural beats, I want to say it was late 1800s. It was the beginning of radio transmissions and things like that, where they figured out that two separate frequencies would induce that effect. But it was the beginnings of radio, that kind of stuff. It wasn't till way later than things like Malta, like I was just showing on the screen, or, you know, cathedrals.
And now we have oscillators and synthesizers, where you can take two oscillators and tune them to get that slightly off detuned effect and beat frequencies.
Yeah.
So that's also why I love music and oscillators and synths, just like you, is because it is math. It's by taking these frequencies and putting them together and getting these incredible harmonics.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly, exactly. And you get to play with that. You can, I mean, if you get into certain reverbs and effects, like you can dial in the dimensions of the room, and you could simulate what it's like for you to do an audio track inside of the Sistine Chapel. You know, things like that, because you can dial in the exact dimensions of the space that you're dealing with. So, yeah. Yeah, interesting. Well, let's start getting into some of these geometries. You've got some great data to share here with us, Jason.
Sure, we can go ahead and cut loose, bud. All right. Now, I'm going to try to like break it down as simple as possible. All right, you know. So, and I'm going to relate it to like sacred geometry as going back to esoteric knowledge, basically. Sure. And you know, when you read ancient esoteric knowledge, especially let's say like Egyptian, or actually most religious texts, they always say before creation there's this void.
Yeah,
it's the space, the abyss, dark waters. In Egypt, it's the dark waters of Nun, and from this you get the separation of light. So Ra, for example, he becomes aware, he says his name, and suddenly he becomes a point of light. All right. So I'll just put this as the sacred geometry of the circle.
Sure.
And the Godhead, which is like the infinite portal of creation, point of light. And this is the emanation or source. So from that separation of nothingness, you get this kind of sacred geometry or first symbol of Atom or Ra. And it's just a circle. Now, for creation to happen, we get into what we were talking about before, which is the Vesica Pisces. And in esoteric knowledge, it's this kind of splitting. It's this polarity, male, female, spirit and matter. In Egypt, Ra basically spits, or Atom Ra spits, and he creates something called the twins of Atom, which is Shu and Tefnut. It's the first of creation, which is air and water, these elements. And it's from this Vesica Pisces that now all creation comes from. All right. So basically a Vesica Pisces is two circles that are spaced evenly into the center. So the left and the right of the circle meet in the middle. And you can see I put those points so you can see where they meet. Now, the Vesica Pisces is really interesting because we see it in a lot of religious artwork, especially in Christianity. So whenever you see, let's say, Jesus or Mary or saints, sometimes they'll put them in a Vesica Pisces, which is very revealing. And even, you know, the Vesica Pisces fish, you know, this was the first symbol of Christianity. And this comes from the two circles separating, creating this creation. So,
yeah, called the Yoni and some traditions, things like that.
Correct. Correct. And so this is just the basics of sacred geometry, where everything comes from. So if we just draw a line down the center of this, just to show you, you get all types of geometry. Here's a 60-degree triangle. And from these angles, you get all the divisions and the golden means and Fibonacci sequence. So all mathematics will come out of this right here. Just the simple joining the dots of this to create the 60-degree triangle. But I'm going to show you the secret teachings, the things that we don't usually see or not really taught. Now, because the Vesica Pisces is kind of like this eternal creation, it's kind of like a fractal. So you can take a Vesica Pisces and now we can place it in the center. So we shrink it down so it fits perfectly in the center, just like this. Now, if we put a red dot at the top of the inner Vesica Pisces vertically, and then we go to the outer Vesica Pisces on this straight line axis, and we connect the dots, we get the 51.8 degree pyramid. All right, so this is like the sacred pyramid or the sacred triangle, and it's the same angles as the Great Pyramid of Egypt. All right, so that not even by doing math or doing just by drawing, just connecting the dots, you get this secret pyramid, which is the angle. So I would argue that the designers of the pyramid, they understood that this is the key, the secret key of the Vesica Pisces. Now, if we take a circle and we join from this dot and we expand it until it touches the edges of the upper Vesica Pisces here, we get the moon ratio. And I'll describe that and I'll just show you that. So you have the outer circle, the secret pyramid or the secret triangle, and the secret circle that is created from the Vesica Pisces. You see this?
That looks familiar.
Doesn't it?
That looks awfully familiar to something I see on my screen regularly.
There you go. So let's take these three shapes. Okay, so I took this circle, this ratio circle, and the outer circle, and I'm just putting them together right here. Now, this is really fascinating because this ratio is the exact same ratio as the Earth and the Moon. So how is that possible?
Wow.
It makes absolutely no sense to our human minds, but just by building the geometries in the Vesica Pisces, you get the exact ratios of the Earth and the Moon. Now, so,
and that is pretty phenomenal. That is pretty phenomenal. And even if you consider, because we've brought it up before in numerous times, that once again the pyramid is not what everybody says it's used for. It's just not. It's used for something else, Jason. And yes, there have been thoughts for a long, long time that it's been used to carry on an esoteric tradition and an esoteric knowledge. And when you consider it, the fact whether or not the pyramids of Egypt are actively aligned to the belt of Orion or whatnot, the question comes to bear. Could it be that the actual geometry of the pyramid itself is expressing that you're showing right there, which is the fact that basically the geometry of the pyramid, if you could bring that up again, I'll bring it back up, that the geometry of the pyramid itself is an expression of the distance from the Earth to the Moon and the ratio of the Earth to the Moon.
Yes.
That is huge.
Yes, like
that's massive.
Yeah, it is for me, this is the key that opens up the mysteries.
Yeah.
So if you take that 51.8 degree triangle.
I have never heard this, Jason.
No.
No, I can't say I cannot say that I have. I've heard it the ratios of the pyramid and tied to all kinds of things, but I have never seen it so easily explained that it is the ratio of the Earth to the Moon.
Yes.
Geometrically.
So geometrically, if we take the 51.8 degree triangle and we put it through the center of this circle, you can see that the pyramid sticks out at the top of the circle. Now, if we go to the center point and we do the radius of what this line is right here, this is the ratio of the Moon, the Earth, and the pyramid all together in one. And it's an 11:7 ratio.
Wow.
And so if you get the numbers of the Earth 7,920 miles, you also get the diameter of the moon, which is 2,160 miles. So it's like we're saying sacred geometry reveals the blueprint of creation, and we can literally see it in the ratios of the Earth and the moon through the 51.8 degree triangle. Now, it gets even crazier, because the distance between the sun, the moon, and the Earth is it's about a 400-to-1 ratio in both size and distance. All right, so we get this incredible geometry between distances and sizes that it's perfectly set up in orbit, that when you have a solar eclipse, the sun and the moon are the exact same size.
Yeah.
All right, so you get all this incredible geometry by understanding this image I'm showing you right here. Okay, so let's just draw a square where the circle is.
Okay.
And then let's expand this circle to the tip of the pyramid. Okay, I jumped ahead of myself. I'll have to switch the slides in order. But if you take the actual pyramid itself from Giza, the Great Pyramid, and they've measured this to the base of the pyramid is 440 royal cubits, and the height is 280 royal cubits. And when you divide these numbers together, or when you multiply 444 times 4, you get 1,760 royal cubits, the height 280 royal cubits. When you divide them, you get 6.26, which is 2 pi. Okay, so it's called the tau. So each side gives you half a pi. Half the pyramid gives you pi. And so 2 radians is 360 degrees, okay? So that's 6.26. So the number of the pyramids give you 2 radians, or 360 degrees. And this is calculations that we use today. It's on our calculators.
Yep.
So the Great Pyramid deliberately embodies the solutions to the squaring of the circle through proportions, with its base approximately the circumference of a circle whose radius equals the pyramid's height. So it's exactly 2 pi, or tau. And it links the square base, like the Earth material, directly to the circle heavenly cosmos, often interpreted as the symbolic or encoded marriage of heaven and Earth. What you're actually looking at is the solution to the squaring of the circle. So you remember these old Pythagorean, how do you square the circle?
Yep.
This is how you do it. So what you're doing is you're building the secret 51.8 degree pyramid or triangle, placing it in the circle. As it sticks out, you get the ratios of the moon and the Earth. Then what you do is you join, you create the circle from the point of the 51.8 degree pyramid and the square from the circle within it. And this gives you the squaring of the circle ratios. So that is the solution. So the pyramid itself, the royal cubits actually give you the solution to the mathematics of squaring the circle.
And that, you know, once again, goes to all kinds of math, Jason. It not only just sacred and esoteric math, like you're talking about for alignments, that kind of stuff. But we're getting into the world of Platonic solids. We're getting into the world of straight geometry. It's pretty fascinating because, that was always one of the shows of geometry, was the square inside the circle, square in the triangle, in the square in the circle. Sorry.
Yeah.
My brain couldn't get that out for a second. So,
and you know, I discuss all of this in the, what is it? The book I wrote, and then Gates of the Anunnaki is the one I wrote. So all of this is in the Gates of the Anunnaki, but I think I'm explaining it a little more simpler right now. Now, Leonardo da Vinci knew this. All the sacred numbers, the square and the circle, the 51.8 degree triangle, the circle of the moon, all of this is encoded within Vitruvius's Man by Leonardo da Vinci. All right. So he knew what I'm talking about, obviously. And if you take a square, if you take a section of the pyramid and you put the insides of the pyramid structure two-dimensionally in this layout, and this is also in the Gates of the Anunnaki, all the sacred numbers that we were talking about with the moon and the earth and all the sacred geometry of the Platonic solids and these sacred numbers, the ratio-wise, you see them perfectly in the structure of the pyramid itself, of the Great Pyramid. And so the human body itself is a reflection of the heavens. It's a reflection of the sacred geometry. And this is what Leonardo da Vinci was trying to show. And, you know, I put these angles here because, you know, nobody really talks about these angles except for me recently. But basically, if you draw the angle of his arms, it's exactly 23.5 degrees from his chin to his legs. To the centers of his legs is all the same as 23.5 degrees, which is the tilt of the earth. So even the tilt of the earth is represented in this geometry structure that we see in the pyramids, the Vesica Pisces, the human body, and the squaring of the circles. So these are not random numbers that people are just coming up with. There's a sacred geometry formula into figuring all of this out.
Well, and here it is right here from your book, where it begins breaking all of that down. And it once again is a massive point to show the fact of, hey, their knowledge of the cosmos, their deep knowledge of the cosmos, their knowledge of the ratio of the size of the earth to the size of the moon. That cannot be understated.
No. Yeah, it's really like once you see this information and you see the ratios, it's the ratios that are really important here, because, you know, you could take it and you can scale it down to something very small. Like you can make like a ring with it, with the ratios. It still holds the power and the knowledge. If you blow it up into a cathedral or a pyramid, it's still the same knowledge. It's just different scales of the same ratios.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it'd be almost akin to a lower key on the piano, you know, something like that, where it is a similar vibration, but just below it.
Yes. So the human body is basically a key or a measuring tool that has been used in the past for sacred geometry. So if you even look at the sacred number of the human body through its bones, you know, the skull has 22 bones, 8 cranial, 14 facial. So number 22 is a very important number. The spine is 33. We have 33 vertebrae. The ribs is 24, like 24 hours, 12 and 12 ribs on each side. Now, here's ones that's not really talked about. It's the hands and arms and the legs and feet. The hands plus the arm bones gives you a total of 30 bones on each side. So you got 30 bones in your arms and hands.
Interesting.
On each side, which gives you 60. It's the same thing with the legs and feet. So you have 60 and 60, and you got 10 fingers and 10 toes. So these are very interesting numbers that we hear over and over again in, you know, secret societies. You know, you talk about skull and bones, or you talk about the Masons, and they're always using these specific numbers. So, you know, we think of the Sumerians and we say, oh, how did they come up with base 60? You know, how do they come up with these numbers? Why is it 360 a circle? Like, why isn't it not just 100? Like, you know, there's certain reasons for this, and it comes from these sacred numbers because we're the measuring tool. You know, for example, you know, you learn in Boy Scouts that basically if you want to know the time, a great approximation is just hold, outstretch your arm. So again, you're using the geometry of your arm to, and you put your hand in front of your eye to the horizon. And it basically equals like 1 hour of time or about 15 degrees in the sky, right? So think about this for a second. You're using your hand as the clock, just like a regular clock. You have your, your hands and your arms. They use the same language,
that.
Right?
I love that. That's great, man.
And so, no, it's true, but it's true, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just so beautifully and elegantly demonstrated in this image.
Yeah. So basically, think about it. I'll just stop sharing. So you put your hand like this. And let's say you're measuring time, and this is 1 hour. You put your arm up, let's say, six times, and you're above your head. All right, so you have 6 hours of daylight from morning till noon, and then you turn around, and 6 hours from noon to dusk. You know, so you're like the clock. You have your own arm, and you're counting. And so to count the 180 degrees, another very special number, 118 degrees, 18. 18 is considered the number of life, right? Have you ever heard that, Chai? Yeah. So it's very ancient knowledge that the number 18 is like the number of God. It's the number of life. It's the secret key is 18. It's 180 degrees of the sky. So, yeah, basically you can count 12 hours with your hands from 180 degrees.
And it's interesting because that works because of the ratio of the human body. So, like, my son could do the same thing. Yeah. He's eight. His arms are a third the size of mine, you know? But the same measurement still works for him because of the ratio of the shoulder to the end of the arm, period.
Yes. Right.
And it's interesting. And like you were saying, as far as like, why did they choose this number? They chose it because of humanity. But not only that, but because of, doesn't matter if you're 3 feet or 18 feet tall. If you're a human, these are the number of bones there.
That's right. So you like, can just count.
It's a solid measurement.
Right. You can just take the bones of your arms and fingers and arms and hands and count them. And it comes to 60. You know, and so it's the same division. Now it gets even crazier because, like I said, our body is the measuring tool. So let me get into this. Now I'm going to get a little. Maybe I'll skip. Because I want to get to that point. But anyways, so here's like finding the directions with the sun. So simple. Yep. You just stick a stick in the ground, okay, and it casts a shadow. All you have to do is place a stone on that shadow at the tip of it. And then you wait like 15, 20, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever that time is, and the shadow will change. So then you just take another rock, you put it at the end of that shadow, let's say after 30 minutes. Well, you join those two and you get your directions, east, west, north, south. Okay, very, very simple. But there's also another way of tracking the sun. So basically, you're standing here. Let's say you put a rock on the ground. And let's say you go to the summer solstice. And you put a stone down right when the sun reaches its limit on the eastern horizon. So it goes north on the eastern horizon. And so you put a stone right there. And then every full moon or new moon, you come outside during the morning, and wherever that sun is rising on the horizon, you put another stone and you just follow the sun across the horizon until it gets, let's say, to the winter solstice. You put the stone right at the edge there. Now, if you just measure from where this is, where the spring equinox is, when you get 12 hours of light and 12 hours of dark, you get this plus 23.5 degrees and minus 23.5 degrees. All right, so you're measuring the time it takes to go from the solstice to the solstice, and the equinox is in the center. It's the balancing between the fighting of summer and winter, or dark and light. It's this,
yeah,
this balance between it. Now, they've actually found calendars like this in sites like Peru,
yep,
where they would actually carve it out of mountain cliffs or hills. And so when it would rise and set on these hills, you would actually know what time of year it is. It's a very simple way of tracking time or tracking cycles. So, you know, I just put, I threw this image from Abydos of holding the staffs, and they're angled mathematically to 23.5 degrees. You know, so it's almost like the staff putting this down. So I believe that they were tracking the sun with these tools. And the geometry, going back thousands and thousands of years, here you can see it with a Dendera ceiling in Egypt, where you would have the Waz scepters placed at these 23.5 degree angles, and Khafre holding the sun disk, you know, pushing the sun across the sky. You know, all these alignments have this kind of code in it. So like we were saying, if you understand the geometry, you understand the secret teachings behind this. So if we take it at the base and go straight up this mummy with the sun above its head, it's the same angles over and over again. It's 23.5 degrees. Either side shows the sun. Could be summer, winter, solstice. And this other degree, which goes through the eye of the serpent and goes straight into the eye of whoever is holding or pushing the sun, it's at 15 degrees, which is takes 15 degrees per hour to move the sun across the sky.
Yeah.
So there's all this incredible knowledge here, but this is what I was trying to get to. And going back to time. Okay. Now there's these ratios that calculate time, and how do we get these numbers, right? Well, if you take a pendulum, all right, and you take, let's say, a protractor, and you pull this back 15 degrees, all right? So you're holding the pendulum at 100 centimeters, so 1 meter, and you have a, like, so you have a string of 1 meter holding it at 15 degrees, and you let that pendulum go, it'll swing 15 degrees, so you get 30 degrees total of swing.
Yeah.
And it measures 52.4 centimeters, all right? So this one string letting go equals 1 second of time. So it takes 1 second for this pendulum to swing. So you can calculate time by 1 second by 15 degrees at 1 meter long. And the distance between the swing at 30 degrees is 52.4 centimeters, which is the exact size as the royal cubit. Okay.
Wow.
Wow. So the royal cubit, again, is from your elbow to the tip of your finger plus a palm. That's a royal cubit. And that's what the pyramids are measured by. Okay. So this is how they divided the heavens. Just like with the hands in 30 degrees, the sky is divided into 12 sections by 30 degrees. Each 30 degree is called a house containing a constellation representing a sign of the zodiac. It takes 2 hours of time for each sign to move through the sky, taking 24 hours to make a complete rotation, 360 degrees. So none of these numbers are random, is what I'm trying to say. They're all measuring using our secret measurements of the human body, our ratios, and applying them to time and space and dimension. So for the Egyptians, they used their arms and their hands. They called it the cubit or royal cubit. The cubit is the cubit is 6 palms. So you could put 6 palms up and down your arm. It's from your elbow to the top of your finger. And then 7 would be the royal cubit, which is about 28 fingers. So if you counted like your fingers and you measured, counted how many fingers it took to go up, it's usually 28 fingers. A regular cubit is 24 fingers. And, you know, I put this scale here so you can see each palm. So from one palm all the way to eight, which is a pole. So this was the standard measuring stick of ancient Egyptians. It's what the pyramids are laid out. And what they did was they hid this and they used this in every single, well, I don't want to say every single, but they use this in technical art. All right. So if you know what you're looking for, you can find this code in the Egyptians' artwork. For example, here's Thoth, who is the god of measure and cosmic order. And you can see he's holding that staff, the Waz staff. And if you measure it, just measuring it with the cubit and royal cubit, you can see that this entire image is actually created using these numbers of palms and cubits. All right, so everything is a teaching. And I'll just show you simply that, like, so from the base of his headgear to his top, it's six. So this is just a regular cubit. From the base of his hand to the top of the Waz scepter, it's called the pole measurement. And so you get the cubit, royal cubit, and pole numbers.
Okay.
And it's the same in, this is another Thoth from Abydos. And I'm just showing you that when you divide and know his cubit, so seven palms, you divide it, his whole body is created using these mathematics. And even those angles that we spoke about earlier, the 23.5 degrees, it's used throughout his whole construction. So this is how we're getting these sacred numbers. So, you know, for example, in the Descent of Inanna, you have the god, here's the god Inanna, she went to the underworld, and it talks about she holds in her hand a lapis measuring rod and line. These were used as astrological tools to measure the heavens and the earth, right? So everybody looks at these and go, what the heck is this circle and rod thing? They think it's some magical alien device. But in reality, they're measuring tools. So that it's using the cubit angles. It's using the cubit and the angles to understand the yearly solstice, the tilt of the earth, and the hours that the sun travels in the sky. And if you understand these geometries, you can see that the entire image itself is laid out to express these very simple angles. All right, so the whole image is created for the sun and the moon declination. So they are highly advanced in this knowledge, and they hide it in artwork. Now, if you go to like the Tablet of Shemesh, you know, he's also holding this tool, which is this staff and this circle.
Yeah.
Now, if you measure the staff, which I did in red, I put it in red, it goes from the tip of his finger to his elbow, which again follows the cubit. So this is like a cubit rod, one cubit, and the circle gives you the royal cubit size. All right. So this is like the key to open this up. And you find the exact same ratios. We're always talking about ratios in the Ankh. So you have this exact same ratios in the Ankh. And even in the artwork. So here's the exact same ratio side by side. And it shows you that whoever designed these images, they understood how to use the cubit, how to use these sacred geometry signs. So if you go to, let's say, Shamash, he's sitting on his throne, he's holding his staff or his rod and his circle, and it's angled, right? So if you calculate that exact angle, it goes right to the center of this star, which is the star of Ishtar, which is the god Venus, right?
Yep.
Now you get an angle of 21.6 degrees. Now you need to know this angle, 21.6 degrees, to calculate the 8-year cycle of Venus, which creates the pentagon, the pentagram.
Yep.
So what you're actually looking at is this geometry, which you actually started with at the beginning. You know, it's this orbit of Venus, and he's basically expressing it, showing that he's measuring the sky and he's pointing it exactly at the star of Ishtar, which is Venus. You know, so what I'm trying to say in this very, very simple presentation that I'm showing you is that just by understanding the Vesica Pisces and understanding how to build this 51.8 degree pyramid, we start to get all these sacred ratios of the human body. And from the ratios of the human body, we start to measure time and space. And this is where we get all our sacred numbers from. This is how we start to calculate everything. And all the masters, what they did is they would depict this information directly into the artwork. They did it all to scale using these ratios just so that it can pass on to future generations when they understand this. So there's a quick preview of how it works. I don't know, like, I'm just testing this out on you and your audience.
And once again, it is an amazing body of work, Jason. And when you start breaking down once again the sacred geometry that is used by numerous esoteric societies across time, you start finding these things. You start finding the fact that one leaned upon the other, you know, that this information was passed down in this kind of way. So, the symbology that is put behind the artwork and the meaning that's put there, for the learned to know. Once again, it was typically, an initiated few that were making such artwork, things like that. So, they would have been taught this, along the lines and been passed down so that they could bring in the next priests and teach them the sacred alignments and everything else.
And, you know, I don't know exactly the force that's driving me to, like, keep looking at this information, because it's just really obscure stuff. But, you know, I hear a lot when people are talking about our ancestors, for example, and it's kind of like saying, you know, they had primitive tools or primitive ideas and, you know, they were just figuring stuff out. When I'm starting to look at this with this type of perspective, it tells a completely different story.
Yeah.
It tells a story that they had a knowledge that was so profound using mathematics, using geometry, using ratios, that basically this goes back even before Plato, even before Pythagoras. It goes all the way back. So, you know, when someone comes up and says, yeah, this is all great information, Jay, but don't you think it's just maybe coincidental that it's just something they just, you know, put together? I don't think it's a coincidence. I think that there is, like, a foundational knowledge here that was already highly advanced.
Yep.
And that there were groups or orders or secret societies or whatever you want to call them, there's elite wisdom keepers that knew that the whole world wouldn't understand this, so that they had to kind of keep it in secret and transmit it in a way that it would carry from generation to generation. And going back to the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which is absolutely a wonder of the world and encodes this message of geometry, of sacred geometry, right in that one pyramid, that for me, it's, you know, you can debate how the pyramids were built. You can debate if they were tombs or not. Like,
yep,
those things are, you know, they can go any direction, whatever your belief system is, but you cannot debate the math. It's there. The only debate is it a coincidence or not a coincidence?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but once you understand the concept and the building of sacred geometry, the coincidence thing goes out the window. It's like, wow, this is a very highly formed understanding of the ratios and the fingerprint of creation itself. And it's organizing it in a way to encode that information just in that one pyramid alone will give you the key to unlocking all this other geometry, all this other esoteric knowledge, which is built directly into the artworks directly into their pyramid text, their coffin text. All this information is built within the mystery schools that have always been there, and they're still being taught today. So this is just a way of simplifying it and saying, look, there's some other thing here that we could be exploring. We can fight all we want on what we believe things are, but there's certain things you just can't fight against.
Well, and here's the thing that I bring up all the time, Jason. I am one of the few researchers I know that says, more red circles. Bring me more red circles, because the more we understand what's in the red circles and can explain what's in the red circles, then the better we understand the known quantitative, and that only narrows down the anomaly. If 23.5 degrees was an anomaly amongst this research, it'd be something different. But yeah, it's a data point that keeps popping up again and again and again and again and again and again. And it goes into Grecian architecture. It goes into, once again, Fibonacci ratios that are used in other art, and even ratios that are used to move our eye to things. So it's one of those, I don't think it can be dismissed as an anomaly amongst the data set.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all over the world. Like, you know, we were talking about Venus. There's a temple in Mexico, an ancient yep. temple that's dedicated to Venus. And the doorway is a 72 degree triangle. The doorway that looks at Venus, it's 72 degrees. That's exactly the degrees of the pentagram that it follows in its orbit.
Yeah.
So it's like they designed the building with the geometry of Venus in it. Okay. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't a coincidence. It's they understood the orbit. They understood the geometry and the movement in the sky, and they mapped it, and they took those reflections and they put it directly into the architecture.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. Even, you know, whenever you start getting into the actual geometry of Chichen Itza, and it just as an audio engineer, the way that the echoed sound works yes. and is meant to work and meant to mimic something, only that cannot be done by accident.
No,
it is intentional placement of things to make things, react in such a way. So,
and you know, we could even talk about symbolism of that, of like the step pyramids as timekeeping devices themselves, and yeah. you know, with the shadow play and the work. If you look up ancient shadow clocks in Egypt, they actually had clocks that were shaped like the letter T or Tau, and they had clocks that were shaped like steps, like a step pyramid. And all you had to do was see where the shadow was on the steps to count the hours of the day. You know, it would go up six steps and there's 6 hours. You know, go down six steps, there's your other 6 hours. You know, so they knew how to follow the sun using shadows, creating steps, all these. There they go. They marked.
Yep, you can see them right there.
So wherever the shadows, so they had this information and knowledge, and it became their symbology. So if you see, let's say, like go to temples and you see like the shape of a T, you're like, okay, well, this is the Tau, or the cross of the sun, which is like a universal symbol of timekeeping. If you see like the steps that go up and then go down, it's also a symbol of the sun and the progression of the hours of the day. You know, even, you know, Horus, the name Horus is the god of the sun.
Yep.
And Horus travels the sky. You know, it's the same thing as like the 12 labors of Hercules. Like
the 12, like, the 12 houses of the zodiac.
The zodiac. It's all, or the 12 disciples and the solar god, you know.
Yeah.
All we're saying is that, well, even Horus, they just rearrange one letter and it's hours. So it's the 12 hours instead of the 12 Horuses. You know? Why is this important today? I don't know. But I think it's a knowledge that the human race will always have, because if we lose all technology, we have all this knowledge built in stone all around the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's honestly, that's the main reason to build it in stone. The main reason to build it in stone is because stone lasts.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, building this into a wooden monument, doesn't stand the test of time, doesn't pass it down for numerous generations in that kind of way. And when you build things on scale that represent the scale of the cosmos, stuff like, once again, just to loop it back around, that image of the ratio of the Great Pyramid being the ratio of the size of the Earth to the size of the moon. It's an amazing and beautiful representation, Jason.
Well, I just want to share one more thing.
Go ahead.
And just to show you here. So here you have Thoth. He's holding the Waz scepter as a pole. We call it a pole or a staff. And you can see that the head of the Waz is exactly two palm lengths. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So you see how he's holding it, and you see how his eye is kind of looking directly over it.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to take this staff where it's equal, so this is exactly a palm width, so it's exactly the size of his hand, and his pole is exactly the same measurement of his arm, right? The cubit. So what do you think would happen if someone is holding this rod that has the mathematical ratios in it to their body's geometry, and they hold it up in front of them and look in front of them, what can they do with that rod?
I guess they'd be able to measure and keep time by the sun at the very least.
Yep, exactly. So they can actually tell scale, distance, ratio, time. Yeah. So that is like a measuring tool. Just by having the rod in your hand and putting it out in front of your body, you will have that ratio, like you say, to measure the sky.
Yeah.
To measure the earth. So these are actual tools. So is what I believe. They're not just symbolic tools. They're actual tools of measurement.
Yeah. Actual, like, you know, carry it with you surveying tool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the same thing with like the Ankh. Mm. These are tools that are mathematically created in these ratios so that we can use them to, let's say, hold them up to the sky and get measurements.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's a lost technology, that people have just lost that understanding. And then now it's just, oh, they're symbolic tools that mean something. But well, no, I think they're really actual measuring devices.
Dude, that is a really fascinating concept, especially whenever you back it up to what we were talking about with the fact of, doesn't matter if it's my hand held out at arm length or my 8-year-old son's.
Yeah.
Who is a third, maybe half the arm length of me, that ratio maintains the same, which means you could get the exact same precise measurement using that exact same tool.
And, you know,
wow, that's huge.
Well, think about it. And my Bible might be a little off because it's been a while since I read it, but wasn't it Aaron or Moses who carried the staff and the rod to get them through the desert?
Yes.
Well, then what does that mean? He has a staff and a rod to get them through the desert.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he could hold the rod and measure the sun and the sky, the stars, know exactly where to lead them.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Jason, man, you never cease to blow my mind whenever you're on this show. You have some appearances coming up, actually. Once again, you have released nothing but amazing material over the last few years. So to see you out and speaking on it is fantastic, because that really is the way to get this information out to the masses as much as possible. Let everybody know where they can catch you coming up, all that kind of good stuff.
I am going to be presenting this and a whole lot more at Contact in the Desert at the end of May in Palm Springs, California. And this is one of my favorite shows of the whole year. So if you can get tickets, come out and see me and see there's so many other incredible speakers. Come to Contact in the Desert. It's something that I would love to go every single year.
Yeah.
It's definitely a party and you learn so much and meet so many incredible people. So I can't say there's so many good things about this conference. So come out and I'm going to be expanding what we spoke about here today and getting into the stars and the mysticism and the gods and how it all relates to this kind of sacred geometry and the movement of the stars and the sun and the moon. So I can't wait to share that with everybody. And I'll be talking about even crazier things, which is like out-of-body experience, altered states of awareness, contact, things like that. So it's a fun time. Yeah.
Well, Jason, once again, always great chatting with you. Always great catching up. Always amazing information whenever you come on the show. Godspeed at Contact in the Desert this year. I hope that goes well. I hope the remainder of your appearances go well. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for this segment. While you are online checking out everything for Contact in the Desert and getting your tickets to go see Jason Quitt and other amazing speakers, folks, stop on by thecrystalsun.com. That is Jason's website. That's where you can get, if you're looking for Auralite 23, folks, that is the actual location to go get it. Don't trust it from anywhere else. There's so many, like we did a whole episode on that. But that's also where you can find Jason's books, Astral Experiences, Astral Genesis, as well as Egyptian Postures of Power. Make sure while you're there to stop on by Curious Realm, curiousrealm.com/stores, where you can find all of Jason's books, as well as other books from all of our guests. When we come back from this quick break, everybody, we will be joined by our friend Stephen Myers from the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. We will be talking about pyramid misunderstandings, misconceptions, things that people get wrong when looking at pyramid construction, things like that on the Giza Plateau. When we come back right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you so much for staying with us through that quick break. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science make an amazing spigeric product using nothing but whole hemp plants. Every part of the plant is used, combusted, reused, every part. Seeds, stems, leaves, buds, fiber, everything is used, reused, and combusted and reused until nothing remains except that amazing spigeric product. Complete on their website with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by True Hemp Science today. Check them out. They are some of the best product that I have found at any dispensary across the country, made right here in the heart of the Hill Country in Texas. Their product is great. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, and as well as getting an edible on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is our good friend Stephen Myers. He is the head of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. You can find out information about him and the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation at thepump.org. That's where you can also get your link to his fourth book, The Orion Correlation Theory is Valid. Why That Theory is Wrong. That book is officially available right over at Amazon, folks. You can find it right there on the homepage of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation at thepump.org. Welcome back to the show, Stephen Myers. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good, and thank you for letting me come back on your show. I really appreciate it.
I adore our conversations, man, because there is a big thing that I have when it comes to A, data, and when it comes to B, belief, and where those two things meet and conflict, you know, and the willingness to accept the fact that they will meet and conflict, not only as a believer in things, but as somebody with a scientific mind, somebody with a critical mind. You have to be willing to accept those things. And before I even knew about your new book, I had titled this segment Pyramid Fallacies, because one of the big fallacies we regularly talk about is the idea that the pyramid was built in the way that we believe it was. Like you were just saying pre-show, the idea that a ramp was inside the pyramid, that it was built via ramp, was all the way through the 80s, you know? And it wasn't until recent scans of the pyramid that it showed not the case. The point that I bring up on the show all the time whenever you're on is, obviously, by everything that Egyptology tells us of the sacred rite of burial and the necessity of scribblings from the Book of the Dead on the wall and spells and everything else, that tomb chamber, the king's tomb, ain't a tomb. If it was, whoever they had put in there, they had zero intent of them ever hitting the afterlife. If it was used as an actual tomb. So those are the fallacies that I'm talking about. And the big one that we're going to get into tonight is your new book, one that I lovingly share all of your posts whenever you put them up on social media. You are regularly making meme images of the Orion correlation theory being false. And I love the fact that you herald this from the top of the mountain regularly, Stephen, because it is, I think, a point where, once again, the confluence of data and belief gets so muddied for people that they don't know how to draw the water anymore, you know?
Yeah, I do know.
So how did you come to the world of Egyptological study to begin with, Stephen? What brought you to the world of studying Egypt and the pyramids to start off with? Let's start there before we fully get into the book here.
Well, I have quite a technical background and some technical degrees, that type of thing. I've always been that way. I collect antique gasoline engines, the old one-lunger engines, and I like historical technology, that type of thing. And if you like history and technology, ultimately you will at least have an interest in the Great Pyramid being a 45-story skyscraper that was built in ancient times. So I had an interest in it and that type of thing. And when I started quite a few years ago, you'd go down to the library and look in the card catalog, pick out a book that's in the library by Egyptologists, and they tell you, you know, in detail how the Great Pyramid was built. And that's wonderful. You know, they tell you all about it. So then I found out something about Egyptology that a lot of people don't know, which is they don't perform demonstrations. They'll tell you these stories about a ramp and the strong back muscles, but they've never moved a 70-ton payload 1 inch, or they'll tell you how they made casing stones. The workers all day long, they made them, you know, with hammers and chisels. But Egyptology has never made a casing stone like those at the Great Pyramid. So I thought that was strange, a science that doesn't engage in the scientific method. And then I read the alternative books, you know, that the Great Pyramid was a weapon or a beacon for aliens so they can find their way home, that type of thing. And, you know, all the other ones. And yeah. I finally found a book privately published originally in 1962 called Pharaoh's Pump. And the guy that wrote that, Edward Kunkel, just talked about how the Great Pyramid was assembled. You know, he didn't talk about gods or language or sacrifices or mummies. He was interested in how the Great Pyramid was assembled, and he thought it was built to be a massive infrastructure, a water pump. So that got me going, and then ultimately we started a nonprofit foundation. And I've been to Egypt several times now, and that type of thing. So, and then here I am on your talk show.
Well, and, you know, once again, your videos. I remember when you sent me the DVD series a few years ago. I sat and I watched them. And the videos explaining how the pyramid was possibly built. Absolutely awesome. I think it really explains a much better groundwork as opposed to things like, yes, a winding ramp or a ramp half a mile to a mile long, things like that. So it's great to see somebody logically thinking their way around the situation instead of just following the paradigm of A, aliens did it, or aliens helped us. I, you know, don't get me wrong. Could it have possibly been something built to honor the sky captains? Sure. No doubt. We did a lot of things to honor sky captains across cultures, across humanity. But I also think that we are ingenious enough as people. It doesn't matter the culture. There is always that one guy that when you stick him on the island with everybody else, he's going to be the professor, you know, like he's the guy that give him some string and some coconuts and he'll figure some things out. You know?
Yes. Yeah. One presupposition I have about the Great Pyramid is that it was built by geniuses, and ancient geniuses got together and created this massive structure, and it had a even bigger return on investment, which was to be a functioning machine that provided prosperity for the civilization that built it. And that's kind of the premise of the direction of research I'm following.
Well, let's get into that real quick, because I think that is important to bear. A, what you believe that the complex was used for to begin with, before we get into the actual book, the Orion Correlation Theory, and why it's not what the Orion Correlation Theory says it is.
Well, what I think was that the Great Pyramid was built using water locks like those at the Erie Canal. And the purpose of the Great Pyramid was to pump water. And we have a video series about both how it was constructed using water and a video series on how it actually pumped water. All those complex passages and chambers were a water pump. So that's the direction of research I'm following, and you can watch both of those video series on YouTube for free. So that is available to watch. They're a series of rather short videos that people can watch, and we've certainly generated a lot of interest in how the Great Pyramid was built and how it was actually used as a functioning machine.
Well, and once again, that subtle, your book, Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine, goes into that very, very well. And the idea that it was used as a means by which to basically provide water for the area, to help pump water for crops, all kinds of things.
Right. Yes. They used the pumped water for many purposes. They used it to certainly for irrigation, but also to power heavy machinery, to create compressed air, and do a whole host of things. I think that the Great Pyramid water pump was the centerpiece of a industrial park or a science center instead of some sort of a mausoleum.
Well, and once again, if a mausoleum, not an incredible, beautiful structure, don't get me wrong, but far from the most decorative mausoleum around for what would have been a king.
Yeah, there's no ornamentation or anything inside or outside the Great Pyramid, and that's because it's a machine. There's no ornamentation in a car engine because it's a machine. It doesn't need ornamentation. No ornamentation on a hydroelectric dam. It's a machine. It doesn't need writing about the Book of the Dead or anything like that. So that's why it's the way it is. It's about the only thing in ancient Egypt that doesn't have writing all over it. All the temples have writing on the ceilings and the columns everywhere else, but the Great Pyramid is devoid of original writing. Certainly there's some graffiti, but other than that, there's no writing at all.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, here's just some images, folks, of the actual King's Chamber. And you can tell there ain't nothing in there. It is strict granite. And even whenever you talk about the construction of the pyramid itself, there are parts that, you know, much like that, if you look at the structure of this room, very tight fitting seams, very well finished, very well put together. But that is not actually the case for the rest of the pyramid necessarily. You know, whenever you talk about the main chambers themselves, the hallways, things like that to connect them, yes. Whenever you're talking about the outer casing stones, yes. But the area between those two is basically just like a stack of rubble.
It is.
That they piled up.
Yeah, it's every part of every machine is as precise as it needs to be. And, if a water pump on a car, the surface that it connects to the engine is very precise, but the rest of the casting is quite rough. So passages and chambers were made to be watertight, but the structure itself is not. It's just to hold everything in place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. To provide the weight needed, the compression on the outside of the chamber needed, what have you, to hold the bits and pieces in place.
Yeah, there was a lot of kinetic energy going on inside the Great Pyramid, and they needed the whole thing to keep it together.
Well, and you know, with that in mind, especially the kinetic energy, break down how this would have operated as a pump in that kind of way for the audience real quick.
Water entered the upper end of the descending passage and went down to the subterranean chamber. And the nature of how the subterranean chamber was built caused the water to move in a powerful whirlpool, like a vortex. And that process in the subterranean chamber used the implosion that Victor Schrauberger talked about in his research. And ultimately, water moved up through the grotto and up into the lower end of the Grand Gallery. And the upper end of the Grand Gallery was used... Let me start over. In the Grand Gallery, they used electrolysis to separate oxygen and hydrogen from water. Those two gases combined are quite volatile. They ignited those gases, and the result was a powerful vacuum, which helped move a water piston up the Grand Gallery. And then ultimately water moved, that vacuum was broken through valves and linkages, and water moved into the Queen's Chamber, ultimately into the King's Chamber, and the output of the Great Pyramid water pump was the King's Chamber vents. So that's a very, simple explanation, but the water pump idea gives functional purpose to many of the enigmatic features that exist inside the Great Pyramid.
Well, and there are numerous things specifically inside of the King's Chamber that point to what you're talking about, Stephen. Number one, whenever you look at, let me bring up that image of the King's Chamber again. Whenever you look at the actual image itself of the sarcophagus, the huge part that is chunked off of the side, the scorching that is along the inside, and even the idea that that there is salt inside the King's Chamber, there is a sediment layer of salt on the walls.
Yeah, in the King and Queen's Chamber, salts deposited on the walls, and we think that was the result of the electrolysis process inside the Great Pyramid. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of features about the Great Pyramid that are consistent with an interpretation of water being inside the passages and chambers.
Well, and especially whenever you're talking about, once again, electrolysis, you do not need a massive amount of voltage for that to happen.
Yeah, no, you don't. You don't need very much voltage at all.
Microvolts, literally, to electrolyze water. When you're talking about water flowing through granite to begin with, it would already be carrying a charge in that kind of way.
Right. Here in the modern world, we separate oxygen and hydrogen several ways, but with electrolysis, but then we use the hydrogen like in an internal combustion engine.
Yep.
This is a machine that was designed to use the combustion of those two things, hydrogen and oxygen, in a very efficient manner, right inside the machine. So I think it's quite efficient. A lot of people say, well, hydrogen is not a fuel. You know, it isn't, but it worked inside the Grand Gallery in an efficient manner, and to create a powerful vacuum, which lifted this massive 300-ton water piston up that chamber. So it was a efficient and powerful water pumping system.
Well, and the two being there specifically, number one, yes, while hydrogen is even, and most people will be like, oh, look at the Hindenburg. The Hindenburg's hydrogen burned off almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Once there was a tear in the fabric, like the gas escaped, it burned off. What you saw was doped fabric covered in lacquer that that was floating to the ground so effortlessly. The hydrogen had burned off long ago. It was the heat of the air of the fire inside of the structure that kept it up. So the idea of hydrogen being there, a small electrical voltage being there, once again, whether it's something like a Baghdad battery, what have you, we know that they had process like that. We know that there is electroplated gold in Egypt. All you need is a small microvoltage and an electrolyte like salt, which once again is coating the inside of the Queen's Chamber. So there is evidence of this process being there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. And, a whole host of types of evidence to indicate there's a profound link between water and the Great Pyramid. Sir Flanders Petrie found what he called Nile earth inside the passages, but it was sediment.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about.
Well, and the whole reason that I predicate our conversation on this, Stephen, is is because we're about to get into something that is very near and dear to the beliefs of a lot of people's hearts and a lot of communities, and that is the Orion correlation theory. And what I want to drive home more than anything to everybody is the fact that you are an open-minded individual. You are willing to court the concept that the Great Pyramid is literally a pump to pump water.
Yeah.
And to give give hypothesis as such, and to give to give experimentation as such, and to show digital models as such, all kinds of things. So you are willing to put yourself out there with a hypothesis. You're willing to say something that is beyond the norm in the world of Egyptology. Okay. And that's why I think these two things are hugely important to a butt next to each other. You know, because you were bringing up some hugely logical points when it comes to the Orion correlation theory. And it's something that I've brought up to people for years and years, is the fact of, but we don't need that. Like, we don't need that as a point of construction. We don't need that as a necessity of construction or a motivation for construction. So let's go ahead and get into this new book. The Orion correlation theory is invalid, and why you are so, I think, ardent in this mission of at least opening people's eyes to the fact of some of this, Stephen.
Well, I'm definitely willing to talk about the Orion correlation theory and how Please. It was developed, how it was constructed, yeah. how it was created, exactly. how they determine what is true, their research methods. I'm very willing to do that.
Let's.
And I know the Great Pyramid has been the subject of two distinct and contradictory correlation theories. The first one was the biblical correlation theory, also known as pyramidology, where they come up with these precise correlations between the Bible and the Great Pyramid, and they're all precise and all of that, and that has certainly been rejected by most people, except for a few religious zealots, mm-hmm. and now the Great Pyramid is the subject of the Orion correlation theory, which came up with a bunch of precise correlations and that type of thing. But what I don't like is that it's both of those theories are based on the same research methods. So that kind of gives a person pause as to why one would be rejected and not the other. And there's a lot of flaws in how the Orion correlation theory creates its interpretation of evidence. One is, we mentioned precision. Precision doesn't validate a correlation. You know, you can come up with two numbers that are the same, or even, you know, a different units of measure or whatever, and then compare them. In other words, cherry pick two numbers and say that they are intentionally related because the numbers sort of match up. That's not legitimate academic research. That is flawed research, to say the least.
Okay. Sure.
And I'll give you an example.
Please.
Okay. Well, we got the Great Pyramid, and it's got four sides, all right? Well, the Beatles, there were four members. So we know that there was an intentional relationship between the two because they have mathematical precision between the two. And
yeah.
So that doesn't validate that correlation. Each side of the Great Pyramid is divided from the apex down to the base into two facets, if you will. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And each Beatle was both a singer and a musician. So, you know, how profound that is. And the Great Pyramid does have a base, and it's known to have the most precise base of all pyramids. The base would be the fifth side. And do you know what the fifth Beatle's name was? Pete Best. Man, look at all these correlations that I'm coming up with.
Well, this off the top of my head. It's much like the Kennedy Lincoln assassination correlations, things like that. Now, granted, that is not saying that ancient cultures did not use alignments of buildings, that they didn't use sacred alignment, that those things didn't exist. When it came to construction of temple site, that kind of stuff. Let's start at the beginning here. Like, explain to the audience, where did the Orion correlation theory really begin, Stephen? Let's start there.
Well, it began by a fellow named Robert Bivol, who you can look him up.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of information, but he ultimately conjectured that the configuration of the three major pyramids on the Giza Plateau looked like the three stars in Orion's belt. And so because he felt that they looked like each other, that there was an intended relationship. And then it went on from there. And that's a pretty fair but simple explanation of the foundation of the Orion correlation theory. But thinking two things that you think look like each other are related is a very poor research method. And extremely poor. I saw a cloud that looked like a puppy dog. So did canines evolve to look like that cloud? Or did the cloud configure itself to look like a canine? You know, No relationship at all. So just thinking something looks like something else is very, very flawed. I make a lot of memes about things that look like something else. but that doesn't mean they're related at all. In fact, the Giza Plateau had five major pyramids back when the Napoleon savants in about 1800, conquered Egypt, and then he brought his savants over to study ancient Egypt. So there were five major pyramids, only three of which have survived. And you can word search five major pyramids on the Giza Plateau, and you'll find quite a bit of information. So if those two pyramids that did not survive, if they did survive, then the configuration of the pyramids would not look like the Orion's belt, and the Orion correlation theory would have never existed.
Yeah. And you know, once again, the idea that seeing something from overhead, and don't get me wrong, like we have the conversation all the time, the esoteric, we were just having it with Gretchen Cornwall whenever you dialed in. The idea of that esoteric concept of as above, so below, and that being repeated in artwork, all kinds of things. And yes, no doubt, everybody, the constellation Orion, if it is visible in your night sky, it is one of the most predominant things and one of the most steady things in the night sky. And yes, coordinates so much in your life. Like we talk about it all the time on the show, Stephen, the fact that all of two generations ago, we still had grandparents, great grandparents who sowed seed or hunted and trapped still or fished by what stars rose when, you know, we were still intimately connected to those things. We are not anymore in that kind of way. But from that point, And the idea of that being a connected part of a society, to go through the effort of building a complex to reflect that in such a way, you really do have to ask why. And not only that, but where has the Orion correlation theory gone since its beginning, and why?
Well, you said that why they would make it look like the Orion, is that what you asked me?
Why spend the time and effort out of 5-6 temples that are there on the pyramids that are there.
That's a good question. The evidence is what's on the Giza Plateau, and explanations are interpretations of evidence. So why they did that is a presupposition. I mean, it's you're leading with the chin. We're not, you know, we have to determine if they created those pyramids to look like the stars in the first place.
Yeah.
That's not a given to me at all.
Well, and that's just it. And that's what I'm bringing up is the fact that that is a large leap of presupposition.
It is a large leap. There's no feature. Here's a good place to start with the Orion correlation theory. Is there a feature specific to the Great Pyramid which indicates there's any relationship between the Great Pyramid and stars? I ask that question a lot, and I don't get very good answers. They say, well, the vents point to Orion. And I say, well, because of the precession of the equinoxes, every 72 years, the sky moves one degree. So the vents do not point to Orion. In fact, they're off by, 60 degrees? That's not very close.
Yeah.
So
for precision.
Say, well, that's 60 degrees off. If you're a hunter and you're hunting for a deer and you're 60 degrees off, that means you missed.
I can tell you right now, there's no way I could have putted 60 degrees of a gap in wood shop.
Yeah. So so the vents are not pointing to the Orion or anything like that. They say, well, they used to. So is that your research method? They used to point to something, and that means it's significant. They say yes. And I say, well, they used to point to thousands of different stars through the millennia. All, you know, the four vents and the precession of the equinoxes, all those variables equal thousands of different stars. So the stars that the vents point to today, was that intended? That's a precise correlation. You know, the alignment is precise to the star, whatever stars they point to. Well, and then by that time you lose them. So you're talking, you know, the underlying aspect of the conversation that I just described is research methods. So to examine the evidence, you could say, well, they were trying to tell us the Great Pyramid has nothing to do with stars because the vents are pointing away from Orion. You know, that's an interpretation of the same direct physical evidence everyone has.
Sure. Yeah. And that's that brings up a huge, huge point, Stephen, which is the idea of when does something become evidence? You know, and we bring that up on the show all the time. Unfortunately, people are ready to call something evidence immediately.
Yes.
No. What you have is a point of datum to add to the data set. And it leads to all kinds of issues because you see, evidence is what we prove things with. You see, and I say this regularly on the show, evidence is what clears you or convicts you. Never let it be anything less than that. Ever, ever. Woe be it unto you the day that you step into a courtroom and that is not the expectation of evidence. Okay.
Right.
You will rapidly have a different idea of, whoa, wait a minute, data versus evidence, the minute you are the defendant in the courtroom.
I agree with you. The way I put it is that those big piles of rocks over there in Egypt, that's direct physical evidence.
Yes.
It's just, it's there. You know, you can measure it. You can hit your head on it or whatever you need to do. What you think it means is interpretation of evidence. And that's a whole different thing.
That's right.
And a lot of people say things like, well, the evidence tells us. And if you hear somebody say that, whoa.
Yeah.
That's a red flag. The evidence doesn't tell you anything. It's just sitting there, not doing anything. In the interpretation of evidence is what tells you. And then people say, Well, the correlations of the Ryan correlation theory are evidence. No, they're an interpretation of evidence. They actually do not exist on the Giza Plateau. They are just an interpretation, just somebody came up with. And they say, no, they're evidence. And I say, well, are the correlations of the biblical correlation theory, they're precise. Are they evidence? Oh, no. They're not evidence. That's all garbage. That's with that Bible stuff.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, if the Orion correlation theory is based on some really poor research methods, as is the biblical correlation theory, then the Orion correlation theory is outside of the realm of science, but presenting itself as a scientific theory.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it is fascinating. Absolutely, I have never once again said or held the belief that aliens were necessary or needed. Do they look like Orion's belt as an astronomer and somebody whose favorite target is Orion's belt? Yeah, yeah, they look like it. But overhead surveying, everything else. Just because it looks like it doesn't make sense.
He has moles on his arms that is the same configuration.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so yeah. No.
Yeah, so.
Just because it looks like it is not good. Other people say, well, the theory is compelling, and so it must be true. Well, that's like saying, I believe it's true because I believe it's true.
Yeah.
And being compelling is not very good. The biblical correlation theory was compelling to 100 million people. And, you know, that didn't make it true. The Piltdown skull was compelling to the greatest anthropologists in the world for 40 years. But that didn't make it valid. So, one thing about the Orion correlation theory that is a red flag is they talk about all these correlations and precision and alignment, but they never talk about causation. You know, they never talk about it. Causation is a third piece of evidence, a third data point that connects two data points together. And without that third piece of evidence, the two data points are essentially cherry picked because people think the numbers match up or there's some precision involved.
Well,
and there's no causation with the Orion correlation theory.
That's literally the phrase that I use rotely on the show all the time. Correlation is not causation.
Mm-hmm.
Just because something is similar doesn't mean that that's the reason it was done.
Oh, that's true.
And until we find a document, A, describing how the pyramids were built or why they were built or what their function was, until we find said document, I'm not talking about like the Tablet of Thoth or anything like that, folks, or, you know, like some mystical, and believe me, I got all the mystical scriptures and stuff back here too. All right. I know the esoteric traditions. I understand that. But I'm also a man of logic and science, Stephen, despite my esoteria and study of such. And despite, you know, the Tablet of Hermes Trismegistus or anything like that, what do we have to show that that is why they were built? What do we have to show that they were put in that position for that reason? You know, we have nothing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. So talk about causation. You know, there's no Book of the Dead or Book of Thrawn or anything like that inside the Great Pyramid. So there's no causation.
And that's why I will scientific, and I will openly invite Zahi Hawass. I don't know if you're a listener, my friend, but the gates are always open. You always have an open invite to come on this show because there are questions like that I have. That I think are honest Egyptological questions. If Egyptology, and we've said it before, kind of cultish in some of its ways, where it's like, no, just accept this as true. but feel free to show me or demonstrate it to me. Yeah, we can't do that, but this is true. There are some issues there when it comes to science. It is one of the oldest archaeological sciences, though. And it's fascinating to see that that is still the paradigm that is pushed by it, is that this was a tomb.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know how they get away with it. I really don't. You know, how they explain how casing stones were made and how to move these other massive stones without no demonstrations. They have, priceless artifacts in museums around the world, departments of Egyptology in colleges around the world. And, Egyptology, believe it or not, is in just as much of a crisis as the Orion correlation theory is right now.
Absolutely.
And we're in an evolution, a revolution of ideas about what is true and what isn't true. So both of those cults, or whatever you want to call them, mystery religions, are in a world of hurt and in crisis.
Well, it's a dangerous, dangerous thing in science, Stephen, and it's something that I herald all the time on this show, is the fact of science by definition is not static. The day it becomes static, it is dogma.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
like, you've chosen for the research to go no further. You've chosen for no further connection to be found, despite other connections being found, you know? And it's literally why science right now is turning to shows like this, turning to the guests of shows like this, is because for the longest time they have said, this is not the case, this is not the case, this is not the case. And then suddenly quantum entanglement happens, and look at that. Two entangled photons look exactly like a yin-yang and the representation of balance that's been used by cultures for millennia. And suddenly, esoteria has a different look, you know, and truths come in a different light and are wrapped in a different package now. And the concept of entanglement and these things that at one point would have been called wizardry, sorcery, are now just technology and science.
Well, it shows like yours that have challenged the stranglehold that Egyptology has on ancient Egypt. And you're a freedom of truth fighter, I think, as much as just a host of a show. And, truth, just to get truth out there is a struggle, and it's always been that way. So we need fighters like you to do what you're doing.
Well, you know, I have always lived by that phrase from Voltaire, that I may not agree with what you say, but I will die for your right to say it. You know, I will die for your right to believe what you want to believe. If that's the case, because we all have a different twist. We all have a different way that we interact with this data. Like I blame nobody out there, Stephen, who follows the Orion correlation theory in the way that they do, that does not accept this episode. In my heart of hearts, like, pray for them daily? Absolutely. That someday their heart will be open enough to accept new data into their realm. But if that data crushes their paradigm so much that they have to shun away from it and turn their face from that glaring light, I guess so be it. You know, live in your happy oblivion. The rest of us are willing to challenge the paradigm and at least willing to ask the question.
Well, you know? I appreciate that. It's really hurt my career as an alternative researcher,
sure,
to be against the Orion correlation
theory.
A lot of shows won't have me on anymore.
Yep.
That type of thing. But I'm certainly willing to talk about the research methods of the Orion correlation theory. People that believe that theory are not willing to talk about those research methods.
Well,
can you imagine a mathematician? You say, well, how did you come up with that formula? And they refuse to talk about it. Can you imagine talking to a physicist or a chemist Well, how did you come up with that formula or that compound? Oh, well, we can't talk about it. You just can't talk about it. But that's what happens when you encounter an Orion correlation theory proponent. I ask, can a Great Pyramid correlation be invalid? And they are incapacitated by that question, which actually is about research methods. It's about the concept of falsifiability, you know. And then I can't even talk about it. Can a correlation be invalid? Because if they say yes, then you're going to ask them how are Great Pyramid correlations invalidated, and that's talking about research methods.
Well, if
and they're not going to do it,
even beyond that, it's the fact of okay, they can be invalid. Now prove the validity.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you've conceded the fact that they can be invalid. So now defend the validity of this for me from the get go.
Right. So I ask him, well, yeah, what about all those precise Great Pyramid Bible correlations? Well, they're invalid. So then I say, well, can a Great Pyramid correlation be invalid? No, I can't really talk about it. You know, it's just strange because it's not, that theory isn't created using valid research methods.
Yeah.
And it is in crisis and will end up in the ash heap of rejected ideas.
Once again, same way with data and evidence, Stephen. I think if you called it the Orion correlation hypothesis, received totally differently, you know?
You could.
Because we still have that want, even within science, that once we say something is theory, it's hit a different point. It hadn't hit the point of law yet, where it's like gravity, where it's proven and we have calculus that shows how it works. Things like that. It's in the realm of evolution theory and Darwinian theory and the theory of evolution, where we have a few skeletons that are very, very partial. Very partial.
Oh yeah.
You know?
I know all about that.
But that theory is still what's held biologically as what our root is, even though it's not the law of evolution. It's just the theory of evolution. So I don't think that there are enough points to go beyond hypothesis with the Orion correlation theory to begin with.
Well, so, it was named, you know, intentionally the Orion correlation theory. If you want to call it the Orion correlation hypothesis, then why stop at a hypothesis? Why don't you validate the hypothesis? Well,
and that's just it. Between hypothesis and theory comes validation and experimentation and everything else. Comes the check of those points of data. Just because you have a field of data and an idea, that's a hypothesis, according to science. You're allowed to hypothesize any wild, crazy thing you want, yeah, man. Yours is a hypothesis as to the hypothesis of this is how it works. And to a lot of people, that may be a wild, crazy idea. To me, just the structure of the cutaway of the Great Pyramid looks like a one-stroke engine.
Yes.
kind of, yeah.
Yeah, so, if you want to get technical, yeah.
So,
yeah.
To me, but, not that crazy. But the idea that you keep it in the realm of hypothesis, and you're saying that we have a lot of data that points to this, everything else, it requires more data, more checks, more checking of math and things like that before it becomes a theory. When you just jump out with a book and say, I have a theory, you've bypassed two very critical parts of science. Hugely critical.
Well, it sounds like you're describing the Orion correlation theory.
That's what I'm saying. When he just came out and said, I have this theory, there's an assumption at that point that data has already been checked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
By society, just rote programming, there's an assumption.
Yeah, and it's not going to last.
No.
You know,
no.
It's going to follow the same trajectory as the biblical correlation theory. You know, the Orion correlation theory became very popular, just like the biblical correlation theory, and then had a long descent into rejection. So that's, you know, hopefully we'll all live long enough to watch it complete that trajectory to rejection. But it's inevitable that it will be rejected. And it's not just me. Other people are questioning the Orion correlation theory, and usually based on research methods and that type of thing. But precision doesn't validate a correlation. Alignment doesn't validate a correlation. And cherry picking data points and then comparing them to say that even though the units of measure are different or whatever, the decimal points in a different place, say, well, the numbers match up. That's not going to cut it in the realm of scientific inquiry.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, this is different. And it's interesting because I paired you up with Jason Quitt tonight, which was all about sacred alignments, Stephen, and how those esoteric alignments were passed along in the artwork, in hieroglyphs and things like that, to pass along an esoteric religious tradition, things like that. That's different than what we're talking about with this. That's 100% different. Those were things that we know that were done for hermetic reasons. We know were done to obscure facts from people, yeah, stuff like that. Those were hermetic religion schools and that kind of stuff. Those are full on real and researched things.
Yeah. But there's no feature specific to the Great Pyramid that indicates it had a, yeah, religious intent.
Exactly.
Or a symbolic intent.
Yep. Or an intent for the afterlife. Unless, once, yeah, again, you were intending, right, yeah, to trap, yeah, a soul there for all eternity.
Yeah, it's a pile of rocks. And the, yeah, Egyptology, who got its genesis from robbing tombs, they, you know, it's just like if you're a hammer, everything is a nail. So if you're an Egyptologist and you encounter the Great Pyramid, that was a tomb.
Yeah.
Even though it's got all these passages and chambers and doesn't look like a tomb, it's a tomb. And the reason why it's got all them passages and chambers is because the original builders must have changed plans several times during construction. They didn't know how to make a tomb. So, yeah, but it's still a tomb, you know, and that's how Egyptology works.
And it's once again, static science is dogma. I need to have shirts made that say that literally.
Yeah, if you pick up a book about Egyptology from 1900, it'd be virtually the same as a book printed just this year, because that science has stagnated into a mystery religion where they all have a like-minded outlook, a hive mind, if you will, and they validate what they think by peer review. So we're going to ask people that already think what we think is right if this is right, and peer review is very overused by Egyptology. I really hate peer review, to be honest with you.
It's a facet. It's a facet.
It is a facet.
And that should be what it remains. It's a facet of science. It's not the end all be all. Absolutely not. Because there's been numerous studies that show that peer review can stagnify things quite literally. Because aren't looking frequently at people with a different mindset.
Yeah. Do you know the Great Pyramid, as its location has never been peer reviewed?
Interesting.
We didn't have to ask a whole bunch of Egyptologists, hey, where's the Great Pyramid?
Yeah.
Well, let's all think about it. Say the same thing.
Let's confirm
You don't need peer review for that because it's self-evident. And the reason they come up with peer review when they are either too lazy or incapable of providing a valid demonstration. Mm. I know a guy that makes barrels, okay? Wooden barrels. It's a craft.
Yep.
I said, how do you make a wooden barrel? I went over to his shop, and guess what? He was telling me and making a wooden barrel at the same time.
Yeah.
His explanation was consistent with his demonstration. And by the time he got done explaining how a wooden barrel is made, he had made one. He is a greater scientist than all Egyptologists put together.
Mm. It does.
Egyptology comes up with an explanation that can't be demonstrated by anybody.
And the experimentation is not there at that point.
Oh no, they don't do any experimentation or demonstration.
Yeah.
Oh, there are exceptions. They'll move a 2-ton stone and say that's how 70-ton stones were moved.
Yeah.
Okay. There, that's simple enough. Well, I can lift a full size car over my head just with my hands. Just grab it, and I can provide a demonstration by lifting a Hot Wheels car over my head. Not very good, is it? It's an issue of scale that makes Egyptology's demonstrations fraudulent.
Yeah. Yeah, because
not just invalid, but fraudulent.
And we've brought this up before. There has never been, even with modern machining, modern machinery, modern architecture, everything else, there has never been a scale replica. And scale blocks, everything else, scale replica of the Great Pyramid built in the scale amount of time. It's never succeeded. It's never happened. Like National Geographic has tried to do it, all kinds of things. It has never been actually accomplished. So,
well, you can accomplish it, I think, using modern tools and moving equipment, but you can't do it by using the methods Egyptology say it was done.
Yeah, no, even using modern equipment, it hadn't been done.
I know it hasn't been done, and there's
a
really good reason for that is there's not enough return on investment to do it.
Sure, sure. That and you probably shatter a few things Egyptology-wise.
Yeah, we could actually along build, the way. I think with modern equipment, we could make a full-size pyramid like in the middle of Nebraska. You know, you can, we cut granite quite smoothly, you know, all the granite countertops that the women like, you know, large scale precision stone cutting, and we could build it full size in Nebraska. And then, the purpose of it would be to tell people in the future that we knew pi. Okay. But to do that would be a very small return on investment, and it would be stupid to do. So I think that the builders of the Great Pyramid didn't do it to tell us anything or that they knew pi, because if they did that, it would be a small return on investment and stupid to do.
Yeah, yeah. And even though you could do it on a smaller scale, it may be harder to find, you know. But that's once again a large, glaring example of we know pi. And once again, just like we started off this conversation about the pyramids being possibly in the shape of Orion's belt. Why have the need to express to anybody that, you know, 3.14, et cetera.
I mean, it's a small return on investment, I think, to build the pyramids.
Well, and I think a small-minded concept of why to build them also.
Yeah, you know? I do. I really do think it is a small return on investment.
Yeah.
And it's something that just modern man made up.
Yeah.
You know, if you lived in the 15th century when all five of the major pyramids existed on the Giza Plateau, you'd say, boy, those pyramids sure don't look like Orion's belt. There must be nothing that they have to do with each other.
Can you imagine the people in New Egypt that were like, look at this trash they're putting up. They're ruining our view. We paid for this nice hillside view, and look at what they're doing to it. Just wrecking it. Wrecking it with these modern buildings. What is that
thing? Building up those skyscrapers.
Some representation of pi? What is that?
Yeah, why did they make us walk up them ramps our whole adult life? Yeah. We didn't like pulling them stones.
Yeah, yeah. I walked up the ramp both ways to get to work every day.
Yeah, uphill. I hate that.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, Stephen. So, you know, it's, you know, they are, the Great Pyramid is seemingly seemingly ultra modern, but it was built in distant antiquity. You know, no ornamentation, you know, no glorification of any particular god or pharaoh or leader or that type of thing. And it's just a fascinating subject to discuss and study. My favorite dam is the Grand Coulee Dam in central Washington, and it doesn't have any ornamentation, no glorification to, the ancient god of FDR or anything like that. And it's just sitting there providing prosperity for the civilization that built it. So I think the Great Pyramid was a big construction project with an even bigger return on investment.
Which I think, as we've said numerous times, just about every time I've had you on, I think makes a whole lot more sense whenever you look at things in the long-term scope of the Giza Plateau, of the people, of why to put such effort into such a project, you know?
I appreciate that. People who are like car mechanics or yard workers or builders or technical people say that this direction of research is compelling and, you know, has a lot to it in terms of, you know, truck drivers and people that actually do stuff.
Yeah.
You know, on how it was built and why it was built, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, when you're talking about the overall communal use, the overall return on investment, that's, I think, public works wise. And maybe that's too much of a modern concept to view it through. You know, maybe I'm putting too much of a modern light on it in my own understanding. But when you're talking about...
I do think it's a modern concept.
Yeah.
But people are the same there as they were, 10,000 years ago. They want the same thing.
Yep.
I know what I want. I want my kids to eat today and to eat tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
And if that happens, that's prosperity.
Well, and that's
I want
it.
To... Instead of having toil, I want leisure. That's prosperity.
Yeah.
And the Great Pyramid, using the pumped water to do a whole host of things, provided prosperity for those who built it. Huge return on investment that was funded by a very wise leader and invested a huge amount of resources to build the Great Pyramid. And it paid off handsomely.
Well, and that's just it. You know, most ancient cultures, most older cultures, things like that, had a multi-generational concept of decision-making when it came to something on scale like this. You know, does it befit, hey, it's going to take multi-generations to build. Will it behoove multi-generations after that? And if not so, we don't take on the project, you know.
Right.
And that's just it. You know, the idea that something like this made such a generational difference in terraforming and in quality of life down the line that it was worth every bit of effort.
I think so. I agree with you 100%.
Well, Stephen, it's always great chatting with you. Always great catching up. I love our conversations. I love this conversation specifically, as well as the new book. Let everybody know where they can go to follow everything from the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, where they can go to donate, where they can go to get involved, where they can go to follow you, and where they can go to get the new book.
Well, our foundation's website is thepump.org, real easy to remember. And that's a portal to our Facebook page, our YouTube channel, and of course, links to my books. My books are both, all of them are Kindle ebook format. The first two are also in soft cover. So, there's quite a few illustrations in the third and fourth book, which would made them pretty expensive for soft cover. So they're just ebooks, and, they can, find out, what we're doing, our activities and our goals, that type of thing. They can become involved. They can ask questions, contact me through email from our website, and go from there. So, like I say, our website would be the best place to start. and find out what we're about. I just suggest people, find out about the direction of research before they pass judgment. That's all I ask people to do.
Exactly. And once again, if you are willing to court something as fanciful as the Orion correlation theory, I challenge you to be open of mind enough to actually be able to look at the demonstrations provided by Steve. It has changed my concept of how the pyramids was built, Stephen. I heard your work years and years ago. I believe it was on Coast to Coast when I first heard it, something along those lines. To have been involved in the way that I am, to dive into this an hour every few months with you for the last many years, has been more than a pleasure and has truly opened my mind to the fact of, once again, we don't need aliens. We don't need an Orion correlation theory. We don't need any of that. This seems like much more of a logical step as to why to put on a construction project like the Great Pyramid.
Well, I appreciate those kind words, and I hear that more and more every day, so it means a lot to me.
Absolutely, my friend. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from Stephen Myers and the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation at thepump.org, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find our videos page. Where you can find the embedded YouTube channels of all of our guests, including Stephen Myers and all of his videos. So nice and easy for you to find it, for you to like and subscribe his stuff. Also, make sure to stop on by curiousresearch.org. That is where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP, out doing field work, out doing interviews with experiencers, things like that, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your back pocket field log to write down all of your experience data in the field as it happens, so it's fresh, good data for science come the day you need to shake hands with science. Thank you, as always, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. Without that, the conversation does not happen. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.